we have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State. Good morning to you both.
Hello.
Good morning.
How are you? I'm always a little bit leery about asking that, especially to you two. But.
That's one of those questions where you really don't want the full and honest answer.
No, I don't.
It was sort of a rhetorical question.
Just
it
to
was.
Get things started.
Oh, we're just fine.
I
How
just
are you?
Wanted a short, cheerful little answer. So.
Hi, here we are. We're ready to go.
Yeah. Well, I've come down with smallpox from some sort of live vaccine or something. But other than that, I'm doing fine. And oh, by the way, I've got a cough. Can you come over here for a second?
No. I'm staying on my side of the studio.
So we were sharing more than notes this morning. Well, let's talk about last weekend. There was a lot of rallies, or at least three rallies. But you say there's more.
Yeah. Oh, yes, there were, and it was very interesting to see media coverage, and very interesting to see the rallies themselves. We're talking, of course, about the massive anti-war rallies that happened last Saturday in New York, and rather New York, San Francisco, and Washington, D.C. And a number of other cities around the country, and on Monday, a number of other cities because of MLK Day, and here in Seattle as well. And the media estimates of those rallies, particularly the very large ones in D.C. and San Francisco, were just remarkably varied. And it's always been a matter of great frustration, I think, to a lot of activists to see, you know, you can see a sea of humanity as far as the eye stretches, and then you turn on the TV or the radio or whatever, and they say, and hundreds of protesters are gathered, and, you know, next, you know, with the interview of the counter demonstrator, and it's. In a sense, you have to ask yourself, the numbers don't really matter. What is very clear with these rallies is that an enormous number of people are motivated enough to come out, and in some cases, particularly with the D.C. and San Francisco rallies, to travel great distances. But you also have, the best site I've found for it so far is something called peacedemo.org. It's started by a former state legislator, actually, in Arizona, that tracks demonstrations across the country. And he has a list of, I didn't count, but probably a couple 300 different communities that had demonstrations over last weekend. And I came up with at least a couple of dozen in which there were over 1,000 people. And that includes places as unlikely as Oklahoma City, Lincoln, Nebraska, Montpelier, Vermont, which is a town of 8,000 people, is the capital of Vermont, had 3,000 people rallying in it. I mean, you know, you go down the list and it's an extraordinary, you know, 2,000 people in Tampa, Florida. I mean, a lot of communities that are not accustomed to seeing demonstrations like this. And you go to any of them, and it's very true in Seattle also. It was true here on MLK Day on Monday. And the types of people who are attending are very different than they have been for anti-war rallies in the past. Much more diverse and much more middle class in a lot of cases. A lot of people who had never imagined, you would never imagine coming to rallies. My partner teaches at a private school here in town, and she had 50 of her parents and teachers and other staff members from the school show up at Garfield on Monday. You know, probably one or two of those have ever been to an anti-war rally in the last 25 years. So it's definitely turning out an awful lot of people who have not turned out before. And at the same time, you had the potlucks for peace. You've had a number of other things that don't involve visible street protests. The question at this point is, will it work? There are a lot of signs that the Bush administration is backing down on Iraq. They're saying at this point that they want to give a few more weeks for the inspection team to find the weapons that they're convinced are there, even though they can't prove it. And even though they don't think the inspection team is valid, and we'll talk about all the reasons for that in a moment. But it's the other question to ask is, what is the mechanism by which this sort of a vast sort of proto-movement can actually have an impact on the public policy? My belief, actually, is that a lot of people are motivated not just by the war, but by much larger issues that transcend political party, transcend militarism, and have to do an awful lot with people's feeling that our government is not accountable, that it's more intrusive than ever, that it's accruing more power to itself than ever, and that it's essentially corrupt in terms of ladling out money to corporations and to economic elites while not serving the rest of us very well and not giving us much of a choice at the election. At election time, and people are frustrated by that, and a lot of that transcends ideology. And so the challenge at this point, I think, is to try and find a way to take those concerns to a Washington, D.C., or even to an Olympia, where there's nobody in either major party who are championing a lot of those views. How do you do that short of building a movement that can turn that can threaten to turn some of those people out of power? Because that, you know, the flip side of the lust for power is being terrified of losing power, and that I think is the one thing that the Bush administration would certainly respond to. A lot of what we'll see this week with the State of the Union address is pointing very much to the 2004 election. They care more about that than really they care about the impact of American policy on the rest of the world. It's a heck of a way to make international public policy, but that's what we're seeing in a lot of cases. So that's the challenge. It's a very hopeful time, I think, for seeing these massive rallies out there. But you know, we got to get busy, and we got to remember that the ultimate goal is not just to have public education and to mass people in the street. It's to change the policies. We got to figure out how to do that.
I know my hopes are really bolstered after last week's numbers and seeing the actual images of the at least the three major rallies.
Yeah. So. Yeah. And the fact that you have so many people also who are not just going to rallies, but who are doing other types of work in their communities as well. It's much deeper than just showing up and waving a sign and going home for a lot of people.
Right. So Monday is a big day in terms of UN weapons inspectors. And
yes, that's true. I want to just kind of go over what's going on. As far as the weapons inspections and Iraq and the U.S.'s role in the U.N. right now, because you're not getting an overview of that in the U.S. media at all. You'll get little isolated reports about what Donald Rumsfeld said, about what the French foreign minister said, or Germany.
And you are getting that if you go on the web and look at the international press.
Yeah,
it's very widely reported elsewhere.
If you look at the British press and the French press and other press sources, you will get some of this, but you have to still have to piece it together. In essence, what's going on is the U.S. triumvirate, Bush, Rumsfeld, and at this point Powell, but also Dick Cheney, are trying to drum up support for war against Iraq. Now, their timing was to let the inspectors make their report this coming Monday and then go into the Security Council and push for a vote for war. Because
immediately,
because in the eyes of the Bush administration, Iraq has not been complying. But what they found is that while they've been going around and saying, well, you know, Iraq is not complying, they're running out of time, etc., what they're seeing is members of the UN Security Council, and not just new members of the Security Council, but the permanent members, France, Russia, and China, are lining up against them saying, no, Iraq is complying just fine so far, and the UN inspectors have not been finding anything, which I think is what the UN inspectors are going to say when Monday rolls around, is that they haven't been finding anything, which is true, they have not found anything yet, and that the Iraqi government has been complying just fine so far. The inspectors can go wherever they want. They've not been blocked at all. And essentially that leaves the U.S. in the position of proving a negative. The U.S. position now is, well, because there is no evidence found, because Iraq has not produced any evidence of weapons of mass destruction, that means they're not complying.
And this, mind you, is the exact same box that the U.S. is putting Iraq in, asking Iraq to prove a negative. Now, because there's so much skepticism toward the Bush administration's claims, you know, the rest of the world is asking the Bush administration to prove a negative
as
well.
No, the rest of the world is saying, well, look, you know, Iraq, the inspectors haven't found anything, even though they've been able to go everywhere they want to, including the places that British intelligence and U.S. intelligence have told them to go in order to find good evidence. They've gone to those places. They've found nothing. Well, if the U.S. has evidence, they have to produce it now. And there's going to be pressure on them to do that on Monday, too. Colin Powell is going to make a speech after in probably in closed session after the UN inspectors are done doing their report, and then he's going to try to persuade the UN to back U.S. military action. And the only way he can do that is if he provides some kind of evidence. And so far, the U.S. has provided no evidence at all. And in fact, the one piece of evidence that the U.S. kept waving and waving and waving, the aluminum tubes that Iraq had supposedly tried to acquire but never actually did acquire, now the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, Mohammed El-Baradei, who will be making that report on UN inspections of potential nuclear sites in Iraq, has said that those aluminum tubes are completely unsuitable for use in a nuclear centrifuge program. They are, in fact, completely suitable in both size and composition for rockets, which is what Iraq had said they had ordered those tubes for, conventional rockets, and not long-range rockets
either.
They are allowed to have. And there's no evidence they even obtained the aluminum tubes that they tried to acquire. And there's certainly no evidence that those tubes would even be suitable for the use in a nuclear program. So the main piece of evidence that the Bush administration has been waving around for months now is crap, essentially. That's what's come to light, particularly in the past week.
And even that one particular component would be useless without any number of other components, which, again, nobody has any evidence that those other components exist either.
Mm-hmm.
So it really is a house of cards, unless the United States can produce evidence that the rest of the world has been demanding for months now, which the U.S. has so far refused to provide.
Yeah, and what the U.S. is going to stress is that Iraq has not complied with the inspections, and that Iraq has been resisting and so forth. But I've noticed that there was one thing that happened this last Monday that hasn't been reported at all in the U.S. press. You have to actually go to the British press to find it, and that's the trip that Hans Blix, the head of the UN Weapons Inspection Program, and Mohammed El-Baradei made to Iraq. And they sat down with members of the Iraqi government, and they agreed to a 10-point plan that would give the inspectors more documents. Iraq said they would surrender more documents, would answer specific questions about the report that Iraq made to the UN last month, that would agree to let the UN inspectors interview scientists in private and provide a longer list of names. That's what the Iraqi government agreed to. The Iraqi government also agreed to enact laws against weapons of mass destruction, something that the UN's been pressing them to do for years now. And they also agreed to search their own stockpiles, particularly of old and discarded weapons, for more chemical weapons shells like were found last week. So essentially, they are complying. I mean, there's no way you can argue that the Iraqi government is resisting. Of course, Saddam occasionally comes out for his for propaganda purposes to tell his people, well, you know, these are spies, et cetera, et cetera. But in essence, the Iraqi government is complying. They're letting the inspectors go wherever they want. The inspectors have gone to places that the U.S. and Britain have said are weapons sites where Iraq is developing weapons of mass destruction, and they're not finding anything. So you can't argue. I mean, the Bush administration is arguing something that's not true, essentially. And they're going to continue to argue that, and they're going to try to push that. Bush is going to have a State of the Union address on Tuesday where he's going to try to make the case against Saddam Hussein, because he knows that he's not made the case to the American people. And he's going to essentially say that, and he's going to be lying.
And this is like the fourth or fifth time that the Bush himself has gone before the American public and said, okay, this is the definitive case for a preemptive attack on Iraq. And you see opinion polls where support for war, and particularly support for war in which the rest of the international community has not also signed off, it continues to erode. The argument is not working with the American public. It's certainly not working with the public and most of the rest of the world. And the Bush administration is finding itself in a very awkward position because of this.
Yeah, and how many times can you argue something, have all of your points rebutted, and then come back with new points and have them rebutted, and come back with new points and have them rebutted before somebody calls you on your crap? Because that's basically what it is, and he needs to be called on that.
Well, it sounds like the U.S. Allies in Europe are doing that.
Yeah. And that's
France,
very nice to see.
Germany. China and Russia all sound like they are opposing
and,
U.S. action now.
Read the U.S. press, you think it's only France and Germany in Europe that are challenging the Bush administration. That's not true. The only two countries in Europe that support the Bush administration's position are Spain and Italy, which both have very right-wing governments right now. Even Tony Blair
he's
is pressing
off, even.
The U.S. to hold off on a military attack because of pressure at home. So I would say the bulk of the European Union is against the U.S. proposals at this point.
As is most of the rest of the world.
And Italy is actually one of the places where the largest demonstrations have been taking place as well. So.
Yeah, that's true.
So while all this is happening, there were a couple forums happening this week. One that the news media saw as important, the other one that they didn't.
Yeah, the World Economic Forum convened in Davos, Switzerland.
Back from their foray to New York City last year.
Posh ski resort in the Alps where they're kind of isolated and it's hard for protesters to get up there. They're sitting down ostensibly to talk about the global economy and how to forward the neoliberal economic agenda. But they found the agenda kind of hijacked over discussion of U.S. policy towards Iraq. And it's interesting because last year, the World Economic Forum was held in New York, and it was just after September 11th, and world delegates took the opportunity to commiserate with the U.S., and it was a very congenial atmosphere to the Bush administration.
This was the first time in 20 years that it had been outside Switzerland.
Yeah, and this year, it was a complete about-face. The Bush administration delegates came to the conference and were immediately assailed by delegates from around the world who are alarmed both at U.S. foreign policy and the upcoming war against Iraq that the Bush administration is pushing so hard for. And they're also alarmed at the way that the Bush administration has undercut civil rights and human rights within the U.S., which has given a blank check for other governments around the world to do the same to their own populations. And that was a big issue, particularly on the first day. And so you had this surreal situation of John Ashcroft, who went to the forum in order to defend his INS and FBI policies here at home, against an attack by Malaysian Prime Minister Mahathir Mohamad, who is not himself a great liberal guy. I mean, country is not known for its great civil rights and human rights record under his rule. But here he is scolding John Ashcroft for doing worse things here at home. So, I mean, that was a very surreal situation. And after he jumped on Ashcroft, you had human rights organizations, people from human rights organizations jumping all over him too. And you had a situation where you had thousands of delegates standing and applauding for a very, very long time at people basically scolding John Ashcroft, which I thought was an interesting situation.
It's very interesting to see, even in situations like this where you have literally the most powerful and most economically elite people in the world that are taking the Bush administration out to the woodshed, in the name presumably of accruing more power to themselves and for the purpose of more economic benefit for themselves and their friends, the Bush administration's actions have become so egregious by global standards and to the rest of the world, and they have had such a pernicious effect on the behavior of what can only be called other rogue nations at this point, that it really is costing the American economy, it really is costing the United States an enormous amount of goodwill that has been one of the driving forces behind the U.S. economic domination of the world over the
goodwill
past couple
is
decades.
All gone.
Yeah,
at this
it
point.
Is.
It's
the,
all gone.
The anti-Americanism around the world right now that has been generated really only in the last 15 months since 9/11. It went that quickly, and of course it wouldn't have gone that quickly had there not been undercurrents all along. But the actions, particularly in the last 15 months, have just been so outrageous by global standards, and they have been so consistently calculated also to flout international norms. You see all of the different international treaties and agreements that the Bush administration has thumbed its nose on. That has had an effect also. all of these things have been adding up. And what they're adding up to is the United States is going to war against the world, or is threatening to. Or is, certainly is at odds with the rest of the world.
Sounds like that goodwill is its disappearance is going to cost everyone, including those of us in the U.S., pretty severely, similar to those recent laws they passed with the goodwill for corporations. You know? I see a parallel there.
Well, and there's also a safety issue for people at home because we're more vulnerable to terrorist attack as well.
Yeah, and I want to urge people, I mean, it's great to talk among your friends and family and like-minded folks about the Bush administration policies, but I think you should talk to people who are supportive of the Bush administration policies and point out to them that a policy against Iraq, a war with Iraq, will do nothing to make us safer, absolutely nothing.
Yeah, there are any number, and we've seen some conservatives making them, there are any number of very good, solid conservative reasons to be completely appalled by the Bush administration on multiple fronts.
Including its civil rights and human rights record, its privacy policies, all kinds of things.
Yeah.
So while that forum was taking place, there was another forum that was taking place this last week.
Yeah, very exciting. This now the World Economic Forum is an annual event that's held in January each year, and usually in Switzerland. In fact, except for last year in New York, every year it's in Switzerland. And for the last, I believe, 4 years now, a parallel event has been taking place in Porto Alegre, Brazil, called the World Social Forum. And the idea behind this is while the world's economic elites gather to try and, you know, carve up the world, you have people who are concerned about the welfare of the other 99% of us who are meeting in Porto Alegre. And it was specifically designed as an event organized by, in, and for people of the third world, people of what were once called underdeveloped countries, although they don't particularly think of themselves that way at this point. And that forum, the World Social Forum, has grown by leaps and bounds. This weekend in Porto Alegre, there will be 100,000 people attending that from all over the world. It's going to start moving around. Next year it will be in India. And the number of course, the networking opportunities among what are in many cases a lot of grassroots activists, and there are people from Seattle and from the United States who are attending as well, as well as many countries in the north. But beyond all of the networking opportunities, the number of different initiatives that are being developed between and among not just different countries, but community to community, that is growing out of these meetings are just remarkable. It's really a very exciting event. Almost no media coverage in the United States whatsoever. And yet, you start measuring the number of people who are likely to be affected by the ideas and the initiatives that come out of the respective meetings. And the meetings in Porto Alegre are not only more exciting, not only more intrinsically democratic, but they're likely to affect the lives of far more people. And yet we're hearing almost nothing about them here. There are a number of websites that are very good for getting reports on it. IndyMedia.org. A number of their different sites have correspondents who are down there from the United States, and they're posting reports all this weekend. And there are obviously a number of the media outlets in other countries are covering this pretty well also. So I'd encourage people to read more about it, because we don't have a lot of time right now, but it's a remarkable
event. It's a great
event.
It's exciting.
All right. Well, we joked when we were first starting things out here about smallpox, and I know I'm not rushing out to get my shots.
All right. Well, the Bush administration's plan to vaccinate doctors and nurses, so-called emergency response teams, all over the U.S. just started this week in Connecticut. And only 4 people volunteered for the shots, and 3 were high-level administrators in the program. So that shows you that there's something wrong. Now, why are doctors and nurses resisting? And so many hospitals, 80 hospitals so far around the country, resisting the smallpox vaccination program simply because it's dangerous and it's unnecessary.
And there's an awful lot of resistance to it among health professionals in Seattle as well.
Yeah. It's a Lyme vaccine. For 2 to 3 weeks after vaccination, you can infect people that you come in close contact with. Susceptible people include babies, the elderly, cancer patients, AIDS patients, people who've had organ transplants like Jav over here to my right, people with eczema and other skin disorders, and people with weakened immune systems in general, including those folks who work with chemicals and radioactive substances every day at their workplaces. Doctors and nurses, therefore, would be a cause of death for a lot of their own patients if they get this vaccination and then expose their patients to it, you know? And I mean, when we stopped doing the live vaccination program back in, I think it was 1972, we did not have nearly the number of cancer patients and AIDS patients around that we do today. And, so the estimate of people who would get sick, experts say that about 40 people out of every million would get life-threatening conditions and one or two would die. That is a gross underestimate because they're not taking into account, that's based on old figures, they're not taking into account the vast number of people these days who have weakened immune systems.
Yeah, the vaccine has essentially the same problems that it had when they discontinued it in the early 70s. As Maria mentioned, I have a very compromised immune system because of organ transplant, and it's spinning the roulette wheel for me every time I go into a hospital because of the risk of infection from, you know, having thousands of sick people in one building.
And not just Jav, but the hundreds of thousands of people who are cancer patients, AIDS patients, and
there's a huge number of people who are in a similar situation to that, and it's not just going into a hospital, because if there's live smallpox, if that's out into the community, it's a tremendous risk for a lot of us. It really is a grossly irresponsible program.
It's completely senseless, because all you need to do is stockpile the vaccine. If there's an outbreak or an attack in one area, you do a ring vaccination. You vaccinate everybody in that area and you contain it, because you can be exposed to the virus and then be vaccinated before the symptoms occur, and you will have protection.
And as we've talked about before, the actual threat of that type of an attack is ridiculously small. It's essentially corporate welfare for the vaccine makers.
They're not reacting to an actual increase in numbers of smallpox here in the U.S. They're talking about if Saddam or someone like him got his hands on that and decided somehow got it all the way over here and used it.
For a disease that essentially was thought to be eradicated from the world 30 years ago.
So actually, your odds are better of going out today and buying a lotto ticket and being a winner.
Actually, your odds are better of dying of the flu.
Your odds are better of being hit by the moon.
last year, somewhere between 50 and 60,000 people died of the flu. And we've had flu vaccine shortages, and that hasn't been a problem for the Bush administration. So that should put this in some perspective.
Yeah, we've had major healthcare shortages, and that doesn't seem to be a problem for them either. We only got a couple minutes left, and we had a lot more to talk about today. So, I'll just give you a free-for-all. Whatever you can cram into 60 seconds.
Go ahead, Jeff.
Just really quickly, how about Mayor Nichols and his Department of Bad Ideas?
Oh, yeah, the streetcar named Paul Allen, where we have a proposal for $45 million at a time when public transit is being cut back and when any number of basic social services are being cut back during an economic downturn. Paul Nichols wants to spend $45 million trying to increase the real estate value of the property that Paul Allen bought from the city of Seattle 2 years ago, that conveniently is all along the line of what Vulcan, Paul Allen's company, proposed at the time, that, gee, it would be really nice if the city put in a streetcar along this stretch of road, and it would help us develop the area. Well, now Mayor Nichols wants to do it. It's an idea that is being excoriated in public comment in a number of forums this past week, but he may try and push it through anyway. You know, another problem, though, is that the city council is pretty much at war with the mayor's office and with Nichols and with his hatchet guy Tim Seiss, because of Nichols' habit of withholding information, making it difficult for the city council to do its business, basically. And so we're about to see open warfare in the next few months between the mayor and city council,
particularly over these kinds of initiatives where Nichols does no prep work with the city council and then just announces.
He just throws it out.
An expensive plan that's not going to benefit anybody but his buddy Paul Allen.
All right. Well, I got a feeling we'll be coming back to that again in future weeks. With that, we're unfortunately out of time, talking once again with Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State. And what is Eat the State?
Eat the State is a biweekly newspaper. You can find it around town in bookstores, coffee shops, cafes, bars, restaurants, any place where you find free publications. You can also find us on the web at www.eatthestate.org. That's Eat the State, all one word. www.iraqisnotbeingcompliant.org. And if you have any tips, questions, comments, or you want to volunteer...
Or send a check.
Yeah, that's right. You can give us a call at 903-9461.
Area code 206.